Welcome to the Rennie Podcast, where we talk about the real estate market and the people connected by it. Our goal is to empower you to make informed decisions and provide context for the real estate world around you. We hope that with every episode, you will become a little more knowledgeable and a lot more curious.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ryan Berlin, Rennie's head economist and vice president of intelligence. Also, here's Ryan Weiss, Rennie's market intelligence manager and Intel's lead analyst, about to jet off to Mexico for a well-deserved break with
his family. So leaving the cold, getting the sun.
It's very cold here.
Whereabouts in Mexico?
We're going to Puerto Vallarta for a week.
I love PB. Yeah,
going to be a mix of beach, pool, and food and drinks.
Yes. Do they have like sitters there for your kids?
Yes, they have a kids club. And we booked it because my youngest is now three and the minimum age is three. So now is the time to go.
That is minimum enjoyment for them and maximum enjoyment for you.
Yeah, the kids club sounds really cool. So I think we're all going to have a great time.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you go into town because it's also worth checking out.
Oh, yeah.
Get out of that resort too.
Yeah. So you'll be planning your trip 3 years from now.
Yes, I will.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I'm expecting.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
No way. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I thought we were prepared here.
This was a good segue.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. What do you do? Yeah, we're expecting a girl in May, and this is going to be my first.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you, guys.
So the voice you're hearing is Jane Chu, who is a Rennie advisor extraordinaire. And we're finally doing this, Jane, in person. You were previously on this podcast 3 years ago. That is like 36 episodes ago. It doesn't feel like it's that long ago, but in some ways, actually, it feels like it could have been 5-6 years ago. But it was in the aftermath of COVID, so we were recording remotely. So it's really nice to have you here in person. I remember advice that you gave at that time about buying a home, that if, and I think I have this right, but maybe I don't, that if everybody wants that 10 out of 10 home, but if that's all you'll accept, then you'll be searching forever. And your advice at that time, I think, was settle or accept like a 6 or a 7 out of 10. And ultimately you'll be satisfied. Ultimately you'll be able to purchase that home. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I actually took that from my counselor, who was giving me advice on selecting a partner, which is now my husband.
Sounds like an eight or a nine, right?
Sounds like great advice.
Yeah, that's what I tell him. But I don't think anyone is ever a 10 out of 10. I'm not a 10 out of 10 for him on his list, but like 7 out of 10 is good enough for selecting a partner and also for a home. Like,
well, now you're married and expecting, so it's good.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So on that, yeah, you've been with Rennie for 13 years now, helping people buy and sell homes. You are a 4-time member of the Medallion Club. So people aren't going to know what that is. What is that?
So the Medallion Club is basically the top 10% of realtors in Vancouver. By way of sales volume per annum. So in Vancouver, there's about 15,000 realtors. So top 10% is the top 1,500 realtors.
Amazing. So 4 times Medallion Club member. And you have also been a Rennie leader 6 times. What's a Rennie leader?
A Rennie leader is basically the same thing as a Medallion Club realtor, top 10%, but now we're also accounting for pre-sales as well. Whereas, the Medallion Club would only be accounting for MLS sales.
Awesome. So you're well-rounded as a realtor operating in the resale and the pre-sale space.
Yes, exactly.
Amazing. Well, thank you for being here. It's great to have you. What should we talk about today?
The market?
Okay.
Anything else going on in the world we should touch on that might affect the economy?
No, I don't think so. Pretty stable macroeconomic and political environment right now. Oh, well, there's tariffs.
Yeah, tariffs. More announcements today as of recording too. Not specifically on Canada, but this tariff story keeps going. The US just announced reciprocal tariffs on anyone that charges them a tariff on anything, on any country in the world. But no details on which countries and how much.
Right. So, I mean, I think that threat is going to loom large, likely for the next 4 years at least. We'll get into it in more detail. Canada's obviously been given supposedly a 30-day reprieve, even though we were just slapped with 25% tariffs on aluminum and steel. But we have until March 1st to potentially avoid across-the-board tariffs of 25%.
Maybe.
Maybe. And I think that's the thing is even if we get to March 1st and a little bit beyond that and those tariffs aren't in place, they will be hanging there like the sword of Damocles above our heads for some time.
I think most people are pretty surprised by this. Like, I don't know if this was really brought up in the campaign when Trump was running.
Yeah, it came up after the election late last year. That's when he really came after Canada and Mexico specifically. I think he was always talking about China before, and now he seems to be focusing on other countries.
So we have to talk about it. It's not a fun topic. We'll explore that a little bit more in a few moments. But let's start with a more local focus and what is happening in the housing market here in Metro Vancouver to start the year.
Let's do it. If we look at our three most common metrics that all kind of talk about activity in the market, so that's sales, that's in the inventory level, and new listings, all three of those are increasing. So last month for January, sales were just over 2,300. So that's not a lot, but January typically doesn't have a lot of sales. So it's up marginally year over year and then still below average. So that's that same trend we've been seeing October, November, December. It's like, it feels like it's a little busier for sales, but not anywhere close to kind of what we might expect in a given month. Jane, I don't know if it was kind of the same for you last month on the sales front.
I think I definitely saw a bit of a lull in December. I think it's just natural that most people are wanting to spend time over the holidays. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the second week of January came along, I got so many calls to list properties and people starting to look at all the supply that's on the market, and they have lots of options and great options. So yeah, I've definitely seen an uptick in January.
Yeah. And you mentioned that supply, there is a lot of supply that we finished the year with last year. We mentioned that last month. So at the end of January, then we had 17,500 listings, which is a lot for January. That's the most in the past 10 years. And we started the year with more, but I think the biggest sort of change and the biggest increase came in the new listing space. So 8,700 new listings, which sounds like a lot. It is a lot. It's a lot for any month, but particularly for January. So this data series, we have 20 years worth of data. It's the most of any January in 20 years.
But then beyond that, so that's one part of it. But then January is not typically a busy month on the new listings front, but I gather in looking at the past, say, 120 months of data, this past January still stands out.
Yeah, so it was the most of any January in the past 20 years. And it was even a lot more than a lot of other months. And, you know, January typically isn't a month we see in a lot of new listings. Like, it's cold. Our market is very seasonal. Although it was even colder this past month, but it was dry. I think it was the driest January in recorded history in Metro Vancouver. Not necessarily for me. Thanks. Yeah, so it was busy. It was unusually busy for a January. So, Jane, did you get a lot of listings last month?
Yes, in January, I had about 5 new listings come to the market. And
yeah, that's quite a bit for January.
I think maybe the weather had something to do with it. Mm-hmm. Lunar New Year was earlier this year.
Okay.
It was the third or fourth week of January, whereas some years it's the second week of February. And I think the weather had something to do with it for sure. So yeah.
Was there a common thread across those listings or those households and why they wanted to list? Like, what was it?
Most of them were motivated by family situation. So a lot of them were upsizers or downsizers.
Right.
Not a lot of investors.
Okay. Yeah. So we noticed, if we look at it by home type, that it was really condos driving this. So condos were the most above average for new listings last month. And we've been talking a lot about how condos are taking up a larger share of overall inventory. It seemed like last year more condos were coming to market as a share of overall inventory. And so we were kind of asking ourselves, was this a lot of condo sellers who didn't sell last year and who were just kind of coming back to market? We know there's a lot of expiries and cancellations at the end of the year. So we kind of made up a new sort of metric to try and quantify, are these quote unquote relistings or are they truly new listings? New sellers coming to market. And so we did, as we said, for any property that was listed in January, was it also listed at any point last year? And so we found that just under half of those new listings were quote unquote relistings, 47%. And the most came in the detached segment, followed by townhomes and condos at each at 43%. And this was a little bit of an increase if we compare this to last January, but it wasn't a massive increase. So if we compare this to last January, it was at 43%. So a small increase, but I think what we're seeing is the driver of this new listings activity isn't people necessarily that tried to come to market last year and weren't able to sell, even if there was slightly more. I think it's other reasons. To your point about upsizers, it could be a lot of these condo listings are people looking to move up market at townhomes, detached homes, thing, or even larger condos, things like that. So I think from our analysis, it doesn't feel like it's people who maybe struck out in 2024 coming back to market in 2025. They're listing now because either a personal reason, a family reason, or they think the market, it's a better time to list.
Yeah, if I were to provide any insight into this statistic, I would also say that it's human nature to try a higher price and then testing the market a couple weeks, they get a little bit more realistic, find a dream home that they want to move into, and then now they're like very urgent. So with a lot of upsizers, we typically would have about 2 to 3 cancel and relist before we find the right buyer at a much more attractive price. So I think that's kind of explains why we see about 43% cancel and relists. Also during the holidays, I think just people want to take a bit of a mental break from cleaning their homes. It's actually pretty, I don't know if you guys listed your home before, but it's really hard to keep your home in a showroom state. Especially,
it's exhausting.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
Especially if you have children, right? So I think that's, most people took a bit of a break in December and then relisted in mid-January. Yeah, so I don't know if that kind of provides a little bit of insight into the cancel and relists.
So
yeah,
you're saying it's a pretty typical part of the market. And it's not necessarily that it's a bigger thing now than it typically is, because there's lots of reasons why someone might want to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's just giving sellers that peace of mind that they are getting the best price out of today's market by testing the market. And so every time you list, cancel and relist, you get fresh activity on the home.
And so you mentioned you've got a few upsizers and downsizers. Do you think their timing is more to do with like family situations, or like they think now is a good time to list from a market perspective?
Well, a lot of it is tied to their own personal situation. It's not so much about based on the market, but actually a lot of people who want to move into their dream homes, they're finally finding houses that are listed at very attractive prices, and that's motivating them to sell their current home for a little bit less to move into that dream home. So I am seeing a lot of people in those types of situations where they're like, maybe typically they would wait it out and try to get the best price out of today's market. They're actually just moving on. They're just like, you know what? It's okay for us to break even because we're buying our dream home at a very desirable price and not as high of a premium as typical, and not as many multiple offers. So yeah, it's much easier for them to decide to just sell at cost and move up.
It's interesting. Yeah. So it's an example maybe of elevated supply sort of greasing the wheels of activity in the market, because we know that when we had the opposite a few years ago, when we had a record low level of inventory, it was stymieing activity because there wasn't much to choose from. So this is a paradigm shift that's happened sort of slowly, and it's persisted for some time, but there is a lot of selection out there. And I'm wondering too, with the clients that you're working with right now, in many ways, as we sort of rounded the corner into 2025, it did feel like we were entering a different kind of market and period than we had been in the prior 2 years, like much lower inflation. Interest rates had come down appreciably. It felt like there was less uncertainty. It felt like there was more stability. Do you think that factors into your clients' decision-making at all? I know you said like family, it's life that happens to people, and that kind of spurs their decision to move, whether it's up, down, whatever, move away. But to what extent are you seeing people sort of respond to perhaps a little bit of enhanced affordability? Is that coming into play?
Yeah, definitely it is an important factor. I would say all of the factors that you mentioned, they come into play, because at the end of the day, people have to afford where they live. And with all the interest rate cuts, it it allows them to get a lot more home. Yeah. Another thing that was really interesting is also, you guys didn't really put this in your notes here, but rental prices are decreasing.
Yes, mm-hmm. indeed.
And yeah, January is the worst time. If you guys have ever rented out a property, January is one of the worst times of the year for people to want to move. And so I think that I saw a stat about it dropping by 10%. I don't know if that would also account for the new listings as well in January, that people are having a tough time renting their properties out. So they're like, might as well just try to sell it as well. And also the climate with the tightening of rental restrictions, government like legislation, it's become less attractive for people to just keep their rentals. So I don't know if that would also be a
contributing. I do think if you're an investor considering selling a rental property, that selling it vacant right now is easier to do than tenanted. So the, you know, if your tenant moves out, just a time that might work for you, because it's easier to sell to an end user a vacant unit than a rented one.
Yeah, particularly in light of the changes to the Residential Tenancy Act here in BC last year. But I think, yeah, to your point, I don't know if it explains the surge in listings and new listings more recently, but definitely those points you touched on as it relates to the investor market. Going back to the implementation of the short-term rental restrictions in BC on May 1st of last year, we did see an initial surge in listings. And then sort of it ushered along a period of a softening rental market. So we know that CMHC once a year publishes data on the rental market. It's pegged to October. So it's sort of a snapshot of the market at that time. The Metro Vancouver's purpose-built rental vacancy rate was at 1.6% per the most recent reading, and that was up from 0.9% the prior year. So 1.6% is still incredibly low, but this is a region where in the past 20 years, I think it's 2 years where we've had a vacancy rate north of 2%. And one of those years was 2020, right? Just a few months after COVID really hit us hard. So we just historically have a low vacancy rate. So to see it go from 0.9 to 1.6 is indicative of, I think there is a lot of new supply, both, you know, in the secondary market and in the primary or purpose-built market.
Yeah, a lot of new purpose-built rental, and population growth has slowed.
It has. And we have seen rents both in the new space and in the existing rental space soften over the past year. And if you read our Rennie Outlook report, which is on our website at rennie.com/intelligence, but Jane, you've read that, I'm sure. We have forecasts for a number of elements of our market, and one of them is rents. And so we are forecasting between a 4% and a 5% decline in per square foot rents in this region going forward. And again, as Ryan said, part of that is demographic, because we expect a slowing or declining population. And part of it is just that there's a lot of new supply. But stepping back from all of that, the macroeconomic environment too has not been kind to investors, with interest rates having risen so much, even though rents were rising. So yeah, tough for them. If you're an investor, it's been challenging. But now as we look ahead, and I think we did see some changes emerge in the rental market last year, and the expectation was there would be some stability going forward, the population changes notwithstanding. But now we have this issue of tariffs.
Hi, I'm Cassidy Bast, Director of Advisor Growth and Career Development of Rennie. Do you like what you're hearing? Are you ready to grow your real estate career? At Rennie, we invest in people. With a trusted brand, powerful market intel, and a full-service brokerage, we provide the tools and insights you need to expand and thrive in your business. Visit joinus.rennie.com and let's talk about how Rennie can elevate your business.
Ryan. Are you terrified, or are you feeling terrific about the prospects of a resolution being reached between the US and Canada in this tariff battle?
I think somewhere in between. I think ultimately the likelihood of blanket tariffs on our country long term are unlikely.
Why?
Because I think while we may see them implemented on March 1st, along with probably some countermeasures from our government, I think the implications for that would be really we would feel them really quickly, both in Canada and in the US. And I think there would be a lot of urgency to resolve the situation. I think ultimately where this is headed is a renegotiation of the USMCA, the trade deal Canada, United States, and Mexico all have. So I think ultimately we'll get to a place with a renegotiated trade deal. And I think there's going to be a lot of nonsense between now and then.
I don't disagree. So why don't we step back for a moment? Pop quiz. What's a tariff?
A tariff is a tax.
On what?
On imports. So the country charging the tariff is charging a tax on any good or a specific good imported into their country. The importing business pays the tax to the government, and then somewhere along the way, that tax will either be passed off in entirety or partially to the consumer. Maybe the price negotiated between the importer and the exporter is changed. The price maybe the exporter charges the importer could be lowered, but ultimately the entity paying the tax is the importer, and things get more expensive for those consuming the good in the country charging the tariff, but there are implications for the country exporting as well.
Excellent.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, tariffs too, yeah, I mean, you can have export tariffs as well to the extent that you wanted to discourage certain products leaving the country for various reasons. But yeah, I think it's important just when we talk about tariffs, there's so much discussion about them right now, just for people to understand that it is just simply a tax on products coming into your country. And when you impose that tariff, it is you paying it. So whether it is a business who will then, yes, ultimately pass off some of that that increased cost to consumers, or directly it can be consumers as well paying that, or governments. And so then I guess the question arises, you know, why do tariffs exist? Why implement tariffs? The big reason typically is to protect domestic industry. So to the extent a country wants to nurture an industry or feels like maybe the competition from other countries in that sector is unfair for whatever reason. They might see other countries providing subsidies or tax breaks to certain industries that then make their own uncompetitive.
And that's why blanket tariffs are rare. Normally they're done with a specific industry in mind. So we see them targeting specific products or industries that, like Ryan, you're talking about protecting. So to put it across every possible thing you import, like no country on earth produces everything that it consumes anymore.
Yeah, and the irony, so exactly. And when we look at the tariffs that are currently in place from the US on Canadian exports to that country, so aluminum and steel, you know, we have aluminum that is cheaper to produce in Canada because we have access to cheaper electricity. And so you might look at that and say, I've heard that production of aluminum in the US is about 50% capacity. So you can see from that perspective why you would maybe want to protect that sector in the US and maybe help it produce more and be more profitable. But at the end of the day, the reason that, you know, the US is buying our aluminum is because we produce it cheaper and they pay less. And aluminum is typically an intermediate product, so it's used in the production of other things. And so if businesses are getting those intermediate products at relatively lower prices, it means that they can be more competitive in selling those finished products in domestic and international markets. So, you know, there is a clear benefit to the importing country in having access to lower input costs. And so we're now in a situation where, you know, we saw this back in 2018. So we're here again, where those costs are going to grow up and it will bring inflated prices to the US in a fairly narrow way initially, but we'll see what happens on March 1st. And so I guess we just talk for a couple of minutes here about some of the implications of tariffs, because I imagine you're getting a lot of questions, Jane, from your clients about them, or is this not coming up yet for you?
I would say most buyers and sellers are not really thinking about tariffs, but they are asking about how that will impact the market. And typically we just kind of advise that we tread carefully with sellers, that, you know, you're not pricing significantly above the market price. You're pricing at a very sharp price or at market price. And for buyers, it also means they might have a little bit more of a negotiation power than typical, because people are nervous, consumer confidence is shaky, and that usually works in the favor of the buyer.
Yeah, because when consumer confidence is low, when there's a lot of uncertainty, people are just less likely to pull the trigger on a deal.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. And I think so that is the main thing that's troubling, I guess, with the tariffs is that it introduces more uncertainty into a market that has been buffeted by it for the past few years, coming from different sources. This is kind of somewhat unexpected, but it's here. So I think that is a downside to the tariffs being implemented. There is a perverse upside potentially in the short run, and that is potentially lower interest rates here in Canada. Why would that happen? That would happen because should there be blanket significant tariffs applied to Canadian exports into the US, that would materially impact Canada's economy. Differently regionally, like Ontario would be hit very significantly, BC less so directly, but overall it would have a significant impact. So the Bank of Canada would be likely to move interest rates lower than they otherwise would have to not so much stimulate the economy, because that wouldn't be, it's not the demand side of the economy that would need support in a sense. It's providing easier access, cheaper access to capital for households and for businesses that need it to get through this period of turmoil, right? So that would trickle down to this region. It would impact us here, particularly anybody on a variable rate mortgage would see, in lockstep with the Bank of Canada reducing, they'd see reduced costs. If you're renewing and you're looking at variable, that could work out for you if you otherwise would have been looking at fixed. I think longer term with fixed mortgage rates, we're likely to see them sort of stay essentially where they are, if not move up a little bit, especially if we get into a trade war, because the increased uncertainty in Canada and the additional inflation that we would see because everything will cost more, especially if it's a reciprocal set of tariffs that we apply on U.S. exports to Canada, it is likely that we would see a deterioration in those credit markets, and that would make mortgages a little bit more expensive. Which says too that if you are maybe looking to buy in the near term, now is not a terrible time. There might be an opportunity now, right, to find a home and lock in a mortgage, especially if you're looking at like a 3 or 5 year fixed rate term. That this could be a good time, depending on
how confident you are in your employment situation, for example.
Well, and that's the other part of it too. Yeah.
I think there were some podcasts I was listening to about how it would impact American imports a little bit less because of the favorable exchange rates. What are your guys' opinions on the tariffs that the Americans have put on Canadian goods, but then kind of like offset by the currency like exchange that's very favorable in the USD right now?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the US dollar is trading much higher than the Canadian dollar on its own doesn't blunt the impact of the tariffs being imposed. But what we may see is further tilt in the values of our currencies away from each other. So with the US dollar appreciating against the Canadian dollar. So in that respect, absolutely, that would mitigate some of that otherwise significant price increase that importers in the US would face. At the end of the day, and I think, Ryan, actually, you alluded to it earlier, you mentioned that Canadian exporters likely, should there be export tariffs across the board, would likely reduce their selling price a little bit. So that burden of the 25% tariffs doesn't fully get borne in the US. Some of it is absorbed by exporters in Canada. Some of it is borne definitely by importers in the US. And then some of it is mitigated by changing the exchange rate.
By how much kind of depends like sector to sector. So if there are easily available alternatives, then a Canadian exporter might have to lower their price more. But if it's something that American consumers, businesses really need to get from Canada, oil being a good example of that, lumber being another one as they try to catch up on their own housing supply, those are things that likely they would need to keep buying in the same quantities, especially in the short term. And so Canadian exporters of those two goods might not need to lower their prices, but on other products where there's alternative supplies, they would need to be more competitive with their pricing.
And on the import side, what's coming into Canada from the US, I believe it's appliances that might see some tariffs.
Yeah, I mean, there's building supplies that are in there as well, including, I mean, we import steel as well, like manufactured products and glass windows from the States. So there is a feedback loop there if we do hit the US with exports with tariffs, where it will feed into a cycle of rising prices that will hit housing as well.
Yeah, I'll just say there's a weird geography thing here too, where a lot of times it's closer to go north-south than east-west. So like BC aluminum going to Washington and, you know, other products coming up from California to BC as opposed to going back and forth with Ontario. So there's lots of stuff that gets produced on both sides of the border crossing all the time.
So the bottom line is, I guess, with this tariff, nobody wants it, really. Most of us don't. There's one individual who wants it. But beyond that, not conducive to economic growth north or south of the border, and certainly not conducive to a healthy housing market here in Metro Vancouver. So I think it is something that may come to pass. But as you said, Rye, it's likely that it would not persist for the long term because it's really not in most people's interests.
Provincially, though, how's British Columbia going to be impacted compared to other provinces across Canada?
Yeah, we have the lowest share of our exports going to the United States, and that's really a geography thing, right? We export more west than other provinces do, but more than half of our exports still go to the U.S. So we, as the least exposed province, are still very exposed.
We are, yeah. And, you know, we send natural gas, we send softwood lumber, we send food, agricultural products. So, you know, these are things too that the U.S. does rely on. Again, the reason that they purchase it from us is that they get these products at competitive prices.
Yes. And again, the currency thing, well, you know, it is another factor there. It's easier for us to produce things that are relatively cheaper to them based on the exchange rate as well.
So before we wrap this discussion on tariffs, Jane, in any chaos, there are opportunities. So with the tariff sort of hanging out there as something that we may have to deal with, the fallout from them, where are the opportunities as you see them in this market?
Definitely on the buying side, I would say luxury. If someone has been eyeing their dream home for the longest time, there's definitely that opportunity to start that upsize. You might just have to sell your current home kind of at cost, but for the benefit of finally getting that dream home. I would also say there are some distressed sellers in this market, people who have already purchased and then they absolutely need to sell, some developers that are in deeper waters. I would say some people who had taken on a little bit too much debt and then the renewals are coming up. So definitely on the buying side for both of these. And then I would say also just Whistler for Americans that are like wanting to purchase Whistler, you know, homes with their strong USD. They're essentially getting homes in Whistler for a very large discount. So I think there are some opportunities here.
Absolutely. That's terrific. So next up, we have Beneath the Headline, where we identify a media headline that requires some more context. And right, you found a good one.
Yeah, I've got one. It's, I think we've touched on this topic before because it's one that gets reported on a lot. It's a sort of real estate adjacent, but the headline, Canadian Consumer Insolvencies just saw a 2009-like growth surge. So these are consumers who are seeking debt relief. So it's not quite bankruptcies, but they're looking for some debt relief. They're in trouble. So obviously rising consumer insolvency is not a good thing for Canadians and for the economy. This article goes to great lengths to show how high consumer insolvencies have become. It's not quite at 2009 levels, but it has been rising quite a bit. And so they're really hammering on this point that it's the most since 2009. And they go to great lengths to kind of paint a pretty scary picture. And at no point do they consider how much the population of Canada has grown since 2009. And so if we kind of consider consumer insolvencies as a share of the overall population in Canada, so I ran some per capita numbers here real quick. Per capita consumer insolvencies in Canada reached 3.31 last year. So three and a quarter insolvencies per 1,000 people. So how does that compare? It is up over the last few years, especially from those 2020, 2021 years when money was practically free, but it's still less than 2019 and it's less than every pre-pandemic year since 2007. So on a population adjusted basis, the share of Canadians who are getting into insolvencies is still actually quite low over the last 15 years or so. Better news. I mean, we still don't want to see rising insolvencies, obviously, but I think when we factor in the size of our population, it's not as bad as it first seems. but not as good in BC. So I did it again for BC, just kind of check. And so BC insolvencies on a per capita basis, less than the national average at 2.42. That is the most since 2013. So a little bit higher here relative to our own historical patterns, but less than the national average.
Right. So it says, I mean, Jane, to your point, there are opportunities out there for buyers, maybe a few more these days than there had been over prior years, because in some cases households are under financial duress and looking to sell and maybe are a bit more flexible on price. But what you're saying, Ryan, is that when we look sort of across the market in aggregate, this is not a defining feature of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it is rising and it is something that people need to, you know, be concerned about from their own personal perspective. But ultimately, it's not a huge share of our economy right now as consumers really getting into trouble.
On the realtor end, when we take a look at listings that are available for our buyers, they typically would put court-ordered sale in the realtor notes. I haven't come across too many in the comments. In fact, I think I came across the zero for the buyers that I'm working with. So I think the numbers line up. If it's 3 in 1,000, then or 2 in 1,000,
yeah,
I'm not seeing many. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we look at mortgage arrears. So those share of borrowers who are 90 days or more behind on their payments. And while that number has risen, it's remarkably low. Like
I think it's in the realm of 15 out of 10,000 households.
Yeah, so really, really small. I think when people are working, they're making their mortgage payments even during times of high inflation or other challenges. I think we find that most people stay on top of their mortgages in Canada.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to our final segment, which is listener questions. And we have a question here from Gemma in Vancouver.
Hey, Ryan and Ryan. This is Gemma from Vancouver. I keep hearing that buyers are coming back, but is it mostly first-time buyers? Is it investors or people moving up? Who's actually driving the market right now?
So that is a good question. I know as analysts here, working with the data that we have, there isn't a ton on the resale segment. So Jane, I want to pick your brain on that in a moment. We do collect information via survey from people who purchase homes that we're marketing and selling on behalf of developer clients that we work with.
So new homes.
New homes, and typically multifamily. And so I pulled the data for Q4 of last year, because that's when we started to see the market kind of the trajectory change a little bit.
October was sort of the start.
Yeah. And then added in January as well to say, okay, the last 4 months, let's look at that. Is that any different from, let's say, the prior 2 years? And there were some differences, at least in the new home market. So you look at first time buyers, they represented 42% of purchasers over the past 4 months versus only 26%. Over the prior 2 years. Investors, as we know, are largely on the sidelines right now. So over the past 4 months, 22% of purchasers have been investors versus 46% in the prior 2 years. So it's less than half very recently. So they're not driving the market. It's those first-time home buyers which are in play. And then, you know, interestingly too, we do ask purchasers if they're considering resale. Some people just, they have eyes for pre-sale for various reasons. They want a new home. They don't necessarily want it today either, right? They're happy to take possession of it in a few years. But in other cases, there are people who are sort of toggling between resale and pre-sale. And we have seen an uptick in the number of buyers in pre-sale that are also had been considering buying in the resale market. So that's at 42% of our buyers versus 36% recently. So I imagine that has to do with just the expansion of options and inventory in the resale market. So on that side of things, Jane, like what's your, I don't know if you have data or if it's what you've gleaned from working with clients, but what is your sense of what's driving the market right now?
I'm having a lot of discovery calls with investors. However, I'm not seeing them close on any properties or show strong interest. Mm-hmm. And most of the deals that are successfully closing are end users. So, and I guess of the end users, about 20% are kind of first time home buyers, and then 80% are upsizers or downsizers. So people are already in the market. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And those are, you know, we've talked about this before too, sort of those upsizers and downsizers where, as we discussed earlier in this podcast, they are making, let's say, real estate decisions based on changes that are happening in their life. And that we do tend to see that group sort of represent the foundation of activity in our market. So, you know, when it's a hot market, everybody's involved for all kinds of reasons. And when the market is, for whatever reason, not very active, you still tend to see those groups obviously transacting. They're buying, they're selling because life is dictating that that makes sense at the time. It's not purely a financial decision.
I'm not seeing a lot of people take the money and then completely exit the market, which is also encouraging that people want to stay in Vancouver. Yeah, so that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Nice.
We'd love to answer your real estate questions. You can either email us at intel@rennie.com or you can leave a voicemail at speakpipe.com/the Rennie podcast. And we'll try to respond in our next episode. Jane, thank you so much for joining us again. It was great to have you back. If anyone wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Email is probably the best way to get hold of me. And it's janechu@rennie.com. And if you just want to take a look at my profile before reaching out, my social media on Instagram is janechu.rennie.
Amazing. Awesome. All right. Thanks again, Jane.
Yeah,
thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning into the Rennie podcast, where we share our passion for homes, housing, community, and cities. We hope that today's episode sparked the same curiosity in you that drives us every day. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on your favorite podcast platform. And if you have a moment, we'd love for you to leave a review. It helps others discover the insights, analysis, and perspective we bring from the Rennie Intelligence Division. For the latest market updates, be sure to register at rennie.com.
Thank you for joining us on the Rennie podcast. If you'd like to learn more, all resources mentioned in the episode can be found at rennie.com/intelligence. To be the first to receive this information, register for intelligence updates.